Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome, everyone, to another Osher Lifelong Learning Institute Distinguished Lecture. Our distinguished lecturer today is Jung Ho Park. He is the musical director and the conductor of the San Diego Chamber Orchestra. Conductor Park began studying piano at the ripe old age of six. 3 years later, he was awarded a musical scholarship to the San Francisco Conservatory. When he was 11, he began playing the clarinet and played in bands and orchestras in his college years. He completed his bachelor's degree in music at UC Santa Cruz and pursued his master's in music in orchestral conducting in Los Angeles at the University of Southern California. From 1997 to 2002, Jung Ho was the music director of the new San Diego Symphony Orchestra and led the San Diego Orchestra from bankruptcy to nationally recognized artistic and financial success. Jung Ho Park has established himself as an acclaimed top-tier musical director. Today, we go backstage with him. Welcome, Jung Ho Park.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Clancy. That was mercifully short. I really appreciate that. Sometimes people go on and on and on, and that was elegant and well done. I appreciate that very much. Well, you know, today we purposely left the subject matter of my discussion to be extremely open-ended, and that was very appreciated as well, backstage with the conductor. And it gives me some latitude to be able to talk to you about two subjects that I think will appeal to a broad spectrum of people who know classical music and people who don't know classical music. The first part of my discussion is going to be talking about what is classical music, how does an orchestra work, what is my job as a conductor, what is the job of my colleagues in the orchestra. How do we function together? Kind of the basic questions, and I hope that you might even have more questions, even things I haven't thought about. Everything you've wanted to know about orchestra was afraid to ask. And the second part of my discussion will be about where classical music is today and what are the challenges that orchestras face today? This is a very serious question, not only for orchestras or even classical music, but for the arts in general. And I think you'll probably find it a fascinating, if not somewhat sobering, discussion. I think the kind of quote that sums up how people feel about classical music is by Mark Twain, and he says, "Classical music is better than it sounds." And I love that because it's a dual meaning. One is that if you have a little bit of understanding, you can appreciate it more deeply. And I kind of feel it's a little bit like wine tasting in that way. The more you know about it, the better it sounds or the better it tastes. And that's what I hope to share with you today. It doesn't take brain surgery, and that's really one of my raison d'etre. My one goal in life is to make classical music absolutely accessible and understandable to everybody. Because I think understanding leads to appreciation, which leads to enjoyment, which leads to investment. And this is the steps that people have to take. Remember that the music that you listen to is not iconic or something that you'd be afraid of. They were just people. And musicians on stage are just people, too. I think one of the funniest things that I get people ask me about my musicians in any orchestra, says, what do they do for their real job? You know, for most of our musicians, they're full-time professional musicians. They may make their extra living from other ways, but, you know, they're not accountants necessarily or scientists, although they may be, but rarely. Most of the musicians, professional musicians of high quality, are specifically that. So don't be taken in by the tuxedo. They pay taxes. They have marital problems. They're just like you. They have sacrificed a great deal, and you may be impressed, but I'm sure many of you have a skill that I can't do. And that's just the case with these musicians. They've practiced long hours, hard work, and they're very flexible as well. You'd be surprised in how far they'll drive for a rehearsal or what they're asked to play one moment and then another moment, a completely different style. So how does an orchestra work exactly? You know, what are the instruments? Well, we basically know there are four families of instruments. Can you name them? Strings, the biggest. Woodwinds, good. Brass. And percussion. Thank you very much, everyone. It's great to be here. You know everything you need to know about classical music. You're correct. The strings are the largest group, and then the woodwinds, which includes the flute, clarinet, oboe, and bassoon, the brass, trumpets, French horns, trombones, tuba, and percussion. And let's look at the strings instruments first. There's a great joke that I love, the definition of a string quartet. First violin, second violin, viola, and cello. But another description is a good violinist, a bad violinist, someone who used to be a violinist, and someone who hates violinists. And, of course, that's not completely true or fair, but there are certain, if I ever were to go back and do my doctorate, I probably would do it on matching personalities to instruments. And violinists, because they have to play a lot of virtuosic stuff, they have to have a certain temperament. And violists who play inner lines have to be very accepting and very, very much enjoying playing inner lines. And cellos, there's a large instrument. You've got to be strong and carry a big instrument. But it's a gorgeous sound. How many of you think the cello is the best solo instrument? Yeah, a lot of people do. A lot of people. Yeah, and I would take it that, maybe another third would think piano and another third might think violin. Anybody think the bassoon is a great solo instrument? Yeah, well, we'll try to fix that later. Now, when you look at the instruments, not all are Stradivarius instruments. I can't tell you the number of times that people have come up to me with great excitement saying, I think I have a Stradivarius violin. I think I do. And it says in Latin, fecit in some year, whatever, and it says Stradivarius. But they're knockoffs. And it was very fashionable to create a knockoff of any period to have the violin look like it was made by Stradivarius. But there is a prejudice that people believe that the best violinists are old Italian instruments made in the 16th, 17th century, and those are the expensive, and they are expensive. But I have to tell you that modern instruments, modern violins, modern string instruments, have come a long, long way. And that if I were to play a modern instrument made by some, even American maker, very high quality, you would be pressed to necessarily say which is the better instrument. I've talked to a lot of different people, like Joshua Bell, about, what is it about a Stradivarius? And a Stradivarius is like a great sports car, and that it needs to be played a certain way, and then it plays at its best capacity. Woodwind instruments, as we know, clarinets, flutes, oboes, and bassoons, they usually come in pairs. And those instruments tend to play solo parts. So it's a very different mentality when you're playing in the back of a violin section and you're playing exactly the same notes as 28 different players. And so the sense of ownership is completely different. When you talk to a second flute player even, they're only playing the second flute part. They're not doubled with anybody else. And so woodwinds tend to be a little bit more independent. And again, I would match personalities to specific instruments. For example, oboists, they deal with a very tiny, tiny double reed. Double reed is, when you take a blade of grass and you used to blow and it vibrates and makes a noise. Take two pieces of reed, cane, and you tie it together and you blow in it and it vibrates and it creates a sound like that. And professional double reed players, bassoonists or oboists, make their own reeds. And it's a very specific, very mind-numbing, let's put it in a nice way, it's a very solitary affair. Because you sit with the reed and you carve it just the right way, and you have to be type AA to play a reed instrument. And they do tend to be type AA. Clarinetists deal with one reed. It's a big, fat reed. It's like, you know, walking a tightrope on a highway compared to a little tiny reed. So clarinetists, I find, tend to be a little bit more relaxed and gregarious. They also happen to be very smart. And I'm a clarinetist, so I can tell you firsthand. But the one woodwind instrument is no longer made of wood at all, and that is the modern flute. It's made out of various metals, silver, and et cetera, et cetera. It's a very brilliant sound, but it used to be made out of wood, completely made out of wood. And, you know, again, you know, if you were to talk about stereotypes of the jock football player, you think of the flute player in high school with the perfect hair, you know, and just being so exacting in her way, usually a her, although it can be a guy. Brass players, however, are the real kind of a friendly bunch. The joke is there was once a brass player who walked by a bar. That's the joke. They are a great bunch of people. They love to joke around and have a good time. And it's a very physical instrument. Playing a brass instrument needs tremendous amount of air and muscle control and lip control as well. I think they probably have the shortest lifespan because it's so physically exhausting in that regard. And percussionists, there's great misunderstanding about percussionists. That people think, oh, you just hit the timpani or you crash the cymbal. What kind of advanced degree you need for that? And if you ever tried it, you would fully understand the exactitude to get a beautiful sound. Nothing is more beautiful than seeing a timpanist prepare for a single note. And I've seen some who just, you know, they're counting, you know, they're profession oftentimes can be mistaken for counting rests, you know, waiting for it to come in. And then they play the note and they have the exact speed. And sometimes you see them sorting through like a dentist looking for the right tool. And they have a whole series of mallets, the soft mallet, a heavier stick here and there. And they search through and they find the right stick and then they strike the note. And it can be just gorgeous, gorgeous triangles. And there's a specific technique to playing a triangle. Cymbal, just the right way to hit it. It's not like putting two tops of a garbage can together. No. It is, there's a specific way you should strike it, and it can be just art in motion. Each large section of the orchestra has something called section leaders. And they're the person sitting in front of each of the string players, string sections, the principal violist and the principal second violin and the cello and the principal first violinist, which is also known as the concertmaster. And whether they should be called concertmaster if it's a woman or a concert mistress, there's a whole kind of a sexist discussion about that, but I'll leave that up to you. And then the woodwinds tend to be right behind, and the brass behind them, and percussion. For many, many years, probably when you were growing up and experiencing the orchestra, it was a very traditional setup, where you had first violins here, second violins here, violas here, and celli here, and then bass is here. And that was a very, very standard setup, which many Americans believe was the way it was. That's not true. Throughout the 18th and 19th and much of the 20th century, this was a more traditional setup. And that is firsts here, seconds here. And you could put either one here, but what is more common these days is celli here and violas here. Now, I would still say that probably the majority of orchestras in this country have this setup. Now, you may see in this a variation they used to call the Berlin setup, where the violas would be on the outside, because, you know, violas are slightly smaller instruments, and why not give them the advantage of sitting on the outside? But this basic setup of the stereophonic violins has become very fashionable to go back to this. Why did this ever become the way, and why was this the way to start out with? If you look at even going back before the Baroque period to the Renaissance period, much music was antiphonal, meaning stereophonic. You'd have a melody over here answered by another group of musicians over here, contrasting each other, talking to each other. And this is wonderful. You know, imagine that if you were to buy a season ticket and you were to sit here, and in this location, you know, and I love cellos and basses, but you wouldn't hear much melody.
You hear boom, 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 boom. Here, you can hear melody go back and forth, like a tennis game. It's wonderful. There's some other things like, you know, the cello sitting next to the first, and the bass is over here, and the low end being close to the top end, and just for technical purposes, it's better to tune that way because you can hear the bottom of the chord, and so many other things. But in the 20th century, as concert halls got bigger and bigger and bigger, and they started building bigger concert halls, modern instruments or the instruments that these guys were playing got bigger and heavier, especially in the 19th century. The necks got longer thanks to people like Paganini, and so you had to play higher and higher notes, and you couldn't play like this, so they lengthened the notes. The strings changed from catgut strings, fiber, to metal wound strings. And that helped, you know, the industrial age helped make that happen too. So now they're really loud. And they changed the setup. So basically, all the instruments could play louder. But now you had humongous sections now to accommodate these larger halls. And the only ways that this brother-sister team can stay together is to physically put them next to each other. But as we go back to this setup, we're finding that the music is better served, that audiences are adjusting. And again, many, many, many professional orchestras now set up this way. Indeed, when we started the San Diego Symphony again, we had the setup, and to great effect, I think.
So when you're looking at an orchestra, how do you know whether they're playing well together or not? And one of the things that I really want to stress is that if you find something delightful, it's delightful. If you find something boring, it's boring. And, you know, people who are wine tasters, maybe they're blessed with a bigger palate. I don't know. But, you know, basically you should buy and enjoy what you like. And that's my philosophy about going to see an orchestra. However, there's some things that might give you a clue that they're well-trained or well-rehearsed. One is that, are all the bows moving in sequence together? Now, sections can differ. But generally, within the section, not only are they moving up and down together, which is a minimum, but the other part of it is, are they moving exactly in the same flow? Does it look like they're all clones of each other, complete copies? Are they in the same part of the bow? Are they using the same kind of vibrato? This kind of uniformity is absolutely fabulous, but hopefully not uniform to the point of robotic. Hopefully they're being expressive as well. That's just one example of what to look for. We talked about tuning. When you hear an orchestra tune, and what note are they tuning to? Ladies and gentlemen, what note
A.
do
they?
An A. Absolutely. Why an A? Why not a B flat? Which bands tune to B flat, and there's a reason for that too. An A is the most common string on the string instruments. It's the string that they all share together, so they can all find that. And A is fairly neutral on most wind instruments. The reason brass bands or bands play on a B-flat is because most instruments in the band, trumpets and cornets and clarinets, are in B-flat. So it's a neutral note for them. But generally, A is a good common note. Why an oboe? Why not a trumpet to give the first note? It's the most pungent sound. It's the most reedy, and it cuts through like a knife without being terribly unpleasant as well. But it's the easiest to hear. For those of you, we were talking a little bit about, you know, what you should be looking for in orchestra once they're playing. Eye contact or the way that they're personally involved is a great measure. But sometimes players don't look up at the conductor, sometimes purposefully. And you know, what separates a musician to want to look up and be happy versus your average musician who sometimes looks kind of, you know, disconnected? And I think that could be the upbringing. Sometimes when I go and guest conduct an orchestra, it's very much like visiting, you know, forgive me for this analogy, but bear with me. It's like meeting a child. It's that you could tell so much about the parents about the nature of the child. Do you know what I mean? Whether they're open and conversant or whether they're shut down and shy. So I can tell the nature of the conductor of how he sort of encourages a certain kind of personality. But it's also training as well. In this country, ladies and gentlemen, American musicians are known to play with great virtuosity. In fact, when they go to Europe, European orchestras love American players because there's great training. But the one thing that if you were to compare a lot of the great American orchestras to some of the greatest German orchestras or European orchestras, is that there's sometimes more reserve with American orchestras, a reserve that is quite surprising if you think about the reputation of Americans in general. We wear our hearts on our sleeves. We like to say what we think. We live in a free society. But why are orchestras a little bit more conservative? I don't quite know that, but it's in the training as well. And that training can be a conservatory or a university. It could be their own private teacher, or it could be even their parents, too. And people win jobs at orchestras through auditions. And auditions are just very, very straightforward. You put out a job announcement for a flute, and then 300 flute players show up sometimes. Competition can be extremely tough. You play in front of a committee, and you play what are called excerpts. They could be the famous flute excerpt from Peter and the Wolf or Daphnis and Chloe. And a committee of people, including the conductor and some of the musicians, judge that person. It's a little bit like American Idol, I guess, in that regard. And you narrow it down. Now, some of the early rounds can be behind a screen in order to avoid any kind of favoritism. If someone knows an applicant, if the difference between men and women, you know, you wanted to, in the early days where women started to make their way into classical orchestras, you wanted to make sure that they were given as much chance as possible. In fact, one of the requirements for women to audition behind a screen is that they have to remove their shoes so you can't hear the light footsteps or the heels on the floor. And once they win a job, then they pretty much get to keep it after a year of probation. If the conductor at the end of the year says yes and the colleagues in the orchestra say yes, then that person gets tenure, essentially, very much like a teacher or a judge would. Now, that's what an orchestra does. And what does a conductor do? Well, I love the word conductor because in physics, do we have any people who are in science? Good. You know, in physics, when you conduct energy from one source to another, like a pan conducts energy from the flame of the fire to the food inside the pan, a conductor takes the energy from a composer or a score, and we digest it and look at it and try to make it come real. And then we get in front of an orchestra, and so we transmit that energy to the orchestra. And then finally, through our gestures and through our interpretation, we transmit that energy to the audience. So a conductor is a great word for what we do. But also like a conductor for a train. An orchestra can be like a train. We're all going in the same direction, and I just have to convince everyone that that direction is the right place we're going to be heading toward. Why does a conductor want to get into conducting? Well, let me ask you, has anyone in this room ever conducted anything at all? Anything at all? A church choir? Or anything? A kazoo band?
As a CEO, I conduct a symphony in communicating with the staff to create new ideas.
Absolutely. In fact, bravo. I actually give a talk to CEOs and business people about you know, the role as a conductor and a CEO. Absolutely. But no one has ever. Do you know why no one in this room has actually conducted music with an ensemble? Because if you did, you wouldn't be here because you'd be a conductor. The temptation that once you wave your arms in front of a group of people is so seductive. wave your arms and to have the sound come at you and to be able to tell people what to do and to have everyone look at you while you're doing it. It is like a drug and people pursue it. And I think that that's, you know, it's a common reason, but it's the wrong reason why one should go into conducting. If I may say, I think, you know, if one is a conductor, you should like people first. And you should love music, and you should love sharing that with people. So in the old days, the management style of a conductor was very authoritarian, right? Toscanini and George Zell and people like that ruled with an iron fist. And today, the new generation of conductors is much more egalitarian. If for any other reason, is that unions have gotten a lot stronger. Which I think is basically a good thing. You know, Toscanini used to supposedly flash this symbol to a musician while they were in rehearsal, meaning you go pick up your 2 weeks severance pay after this rehearsal. And conductors could hire and fire at will. Now, which is a really sick way of, if you think about it, because classical music, as I tell my musicians and as I tell my students, the only reason one is a musician is because you do it out of love. You create love, and you want to share that love. I guess it's like a good chef, you know, someone who wants to do that. But I think that it's a good thing that management styles have changed. We teach, we train our orchestras, we inspire them, but we are not absolutely necessary, ladies and gentlemen. I think people ask, you know, what do you do up there? I get that question a lot. What exactly do you do? What are you waving your arms? And I'll talk to you about that in just a moment, about the hand gestures. But in the end, if I were to fall over and it was a piece by Beethoven or Tchaikovsky or something that was fairly straightforward, chances are the orchestra could finish the piece without me. And most conductors. And very delightfully so, probably. When Bernstein passed away, the New York Philharmonic got together, I don't know if you remember this, and they actually performed his Candide overture without him. And it was an empty podium. Very, very dramatic. Very, very dramatic. And the New York Philharmonic, when it went to North Korea and performed there, they actually performed without Lauren Mazel on the podium. And part of it may have been a nod toward Leonard Bernstein and all of his great vision for international peace, his desire. Remember when the Berlin fell down and he did Beethoven's Ninth and replaced the German word for joy, for freedom, and all that. But I think it was also a kind of subliminal comment to the dictator in North Korea that not all societies need to have a leader to function well. So let's talk a little bit about what these hand gestures are. And if I may be so bold, I'd like to give you a very quick conducting lesson. And you're going to find out how easy it is, actually. Let's start with which hand does the conducting, the beat pattern. That's your right hand. And so usually the technical meters, if it's in three or if it's in two, is done with the right hand. And the expressive hand, they say, is the left hand. And I say they say because it doesn't mean that this hand can't be expressive or this hand can't be useful. So if I may ask you to go conduct with me, we're going to conduct a simple two pattern, okay? And it's basically a backwards J. And one, two, one, two, one, two, one, two. And that's a two pattern. And now here's a three pattern. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. Perfect. And now a four pattern. It's one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. Or as we used to say in conducting class, floor, window, door, ceiling, floor, window, door, ceiling. People get this mixed up and they'll do this backward as well. And so that's a four pattern. And so here's a speed drill that we have for conducting students. I'm going to tell you what pattern, in the middle of your pattern, you have to change immediately. Okay? Here we go. We'll start with the two pattern. One, two, one, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, three, one, two, two, one, two, one, two. Very good. Very good. And now you get your master's degree in conducting. No, not quite. This hand is the expression hand, and you control its dynamic and color and anything that your hand can do. And one of the most beautiful hands in the business, I remember, was Leopold Stokowski. He conducted without a baton, and he had these long, beautiful fingers. But generally, we're taught that that this controls dynamics. So let's make the orchestra louder. So you start from a neutral position here, and you go up, louder, 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 and then softer, 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 softer. Now, we're going to try something, two things at the same time. We're going to conduct in a four pattern. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. I'm going to go one measure up, louder, one measure down, quieter. Okay? One, two, three, and louder, 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 quieter, 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 louder, 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 quieter, quieter, quieter. Now, here's the trick, is you have to make sure it doesn't look like this. Louder, 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 quieter, quieter, quieter. It has to look smooth and effortless like this. And conductors do start looking in the mirror and making sure everything looks good and precise. And this hand also can be used for giving cues, like trumpets, oh, flutes, you know, et cetera, et cetera. This hand can be, but what we really try to avoid is something called mirroring. That doesn't do much at all. Once, you know, we've got the technical aspects, then we go to the score. And the score is the Bible. I have to say that when I was starting off as a conducting student, I thought conducting was about looking good. You know, your hair and wearing playing the maestro. And I had a very good conducting teacher who taught me that the most important person is absolutely the composer. So we take a score, let's say it's Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and you look at it in terms of the structure. The amazing, amazing structure. I could talk for 2 days about why Beethoven's Ninth is so monumental structurally. And they look at the melodies, the tunes, if you will, and see how they compare. I look at the orchestration. Why did he give this melody to the French horns as opposed to the bassoons? Why is the cello having the melody the second time when you gave it to the violins the first time? These are things you don't think about. It's like walking into someone's house. Why did they choose that sofa? Why did they choose that painting? There was a moment of decision for every design. And then I love to look at the historical context. One of the difficult things with classical music is that it doesn't exist in the time that it was written. I would love to take my audiences back to a dusty and hot and smelly Vienna of the 18th century. That would, and the turmoil and the political sense of having, you know, an aristocracy and all of this stuff. The music has been extracted and dehydrated today. We don't have that context. It would be kind of like listening to the Beatles without a bunch of screaming young girls. Can you imagine? It would be wrong if they, you know, if someone found a recording of them without that kind of context. So I'll get to that a little bit later, how we rehydrate classical music. And then there's a lot of technical things that I have to do as a conductor. I have to plan the rehearsal very, very carefully, like a train conductor. I have to make sure that all the pieces are covered during the amount of rehearsal time I have, which for a classical performance is usually four rehearsals, only four 2.5-hour rehearsals. How is a conductor chosen? Well, I like a musician. Usually, an orchestra, when they're looking for a new conductor, will put out a list, and it will not be uncommon to get hundreds and hundreds of applications for a single conductor position. A lot of conductors out there. And then they narrow it down, and then they do a test drive, and they ask a conductor to conduct a concert, and you meet the orchestra, and you rehearse with them, ideally. And then, you know, today a conductor has to do much more than just look pretty on the podium, or even to conduct well. They have to be a good business person, I believe, as well. You know, if I can just skip for just back to the technique, those of you who know me, I don't use a baton like Leopold Stokowski, but also like Kurt Mazur, the former music director of the New York Philharmonic, and another great conductor, Pierre Boulez. A baton is basically an aid, and there's no problem with it, but Bernstein often would eschew a baton and use his hands. And for me, that's kind of a comfort issue. Okay, we talked about that. when I work with a soloist and when I put a program together, I am very much like a chef putting a menu together. And the concert has to make sense. If I began with a loud contemporary work and then went to something so delicate like maybe you know, a Debussy tone poem, that would be wrong. That'd be like giving you a big spicy tamale and then and a very delicate crepe after that. It would be contrary. So a good conductor prepares the concerts so it makes sense from beginning to end. Like a, well, it's not unlike an appetizer and then like a soup and salad and then the entree and then maybe a dessert encore. And the soloists are up to the taste of the conductor. I personally like soloists who are very dynamic and extremely engrossing. You know, I love to have someone who just leaves you going, wow. You know, there are a lot of safe soloists out there, but I don't believe today you come to a concert to feel safe. I think you want to be wowed. And when I work with a soloist, I like to find someone who's very compatible with me. I like to find somebody who is easy to work with. Sometimes when I work with a soloist, it's very much like being a cab driver. You know, person says, take me to 52nd and 3rd, you know, whatever. Okay, you know, and there's not a lot of dialogue. Sometimes the person works and it's very collaborative. And I was amazed on how some of the really famous soloists I've worked with, Joshua Bell or Yo-Yo Ma, how they will talk about the piece with great give and take and openness. And it's sometimes the young upstart that says, no, it's got to be this way. And so, you know, I'm a musician too. I like to have fun. And when the soloist can make that fun for me and fun for the orchestra, well, then you got something. I'll invite them back. Another thing about conductors is that it's becoming much more pluralist, I'm thankfully to say. Not quickly, but there are some openings, particularly in the field for women. One of the most, you know, wonderful recent appointments is with the Baltimore Symphony and Mara Nalsop. And that's a very major position, and we're very pleased to have her leading in that area. But she's not the first woman conductor of prominence. There are others, Joanne Folletta in Buffalo, and she also has Virginia Symphony, Sarah Caldwell in Boston for many, many years. And so it's becoming very, very accepted now that there are extraordinary women conductors out there in that regard. There is a bias, however, I think, that is slowly changing in this country for foreign conductors. Back in the 20th century, it was believed that in order to bring any kind of authenticity, and I understand this, you had to have a foreign name and you had to speak with a foreign accent to lead an orchestra with any authority. And I think that that's finally changing. But slowly, you know, we have Michael Tilson Thomas, which is wonderful, and you have Bob Spano in Atlanta, and I think you're going to start to see more American conductors in front of American orchestras, which seem completely correct to me. It makes absolute sense. The one thing about conducting that I never learned, that no conductor is ever prepared to do, are things like fundraising and how to talk to a board. And how to be involved with the community. These are things I had to learn by myself, and I think a lot of conductors are having to learn through the School of Hard Knocks. And I have to say that for me, when I came first to San Diego to work with the symphony, that was an incredible opportunity for me, but it was also the most important part of my education, because when the symphony went bankrupt, it was an interesting phenomenon, because here you had one of the wealthiest metropolitan areas in the country at the time. And and yet they weren't interested in classical music. And so they chose a young upstart to do something that a lot of very fine, fine conductors and fine, fine executive directors tried but couldn't do. And I think what made the difference was that, first off, I was a Californian. I was born and raised in San Francisco, and I was 30-something, so I understood the divide that was happening between the traditional audiences and the next generation. And so we tried to create a completely different image, a different purpose of why classical music existed for a city. And I'm very pleased to say that we succeeded. But none of this was prepared by my conducting teacher. Am I resentful about that? No. Because there's no way that my conducting teacher, who had lived in academe for many decades, could have ever known that, or ever known that there was going to be an ice age for classical music. I'd like to speak a little bit about the challenges that face the arts in general in this country. The news is quite catastrophic, almost as bad as what's happening in Wall Street right now. Museums and ballet companies and theater companies and everyone, symphony orchestras, of course, are facing difficult times. And aside from the economic difficulties, this trend was happening before that. And how did we get from where we are to where we were, which was a very healthy classical music scene in the early part of the 20th century? Well, if we take a look and understand what classical music was back then, it was basically an immigrant story. You had European immigrants coming and classically trained, and not only Italian immigrants and German immigrants, but Jewish immigrants as well. And so this was their music. It wasn't only just great music, but it was cultural. And somewhere along the age of the Industrial Revolution, where you had mega millionaires and lots of wealth in this country, you started having benefactors and concert halls being built. And then it became a very unplanned way to separate the classes. If you had money, if you had education, then you were allowed in, essentially. And that's, I think, was kind of the beginning of the end until you hit someone like Leonard Bernstein back in the 1960s with his wonderful Omnibus series or Young People's Concerts. Do you remember seeing those on CBS?
Yes.
Yes, they should be treasured and admired even today. But here was, again, an American, even though he was a Harvard grad, and he spoke in a way that made classical music every person's music, America's music. But I would have to say that he was far outweighed by the traditional kind of European staid quality. And that worked well to a certain extent. But some other things helped gnaw at the people's perception of what classical music should be or could be. With the very first recording, we heard a recording of Brahms earlier. Imagine with the very first cylinder or gramophone recording, it then became possible to experience music without that human being in a room. We talk about virtual reality, oh my goodness, and iPods and computers and all that. That revolution started decades and decades ago with the first recording, and then radio. And radio, of course, was the great populist. It made everyone, no matter if you were in the farm, on the farm in some hinterland or in some metropolitan area, everyone could listen to Toscanini, you know, or everyone could hear Yasha Heifetz or Jack Benny. And it was a great equalizer. And it was a good thing. It was a good thing, essentially. Well, at least we believed it was. Slowly over time, however, thanks to LPs and then tapes and then CDs and now iPods, and what is next? We are becoming further and further apart from each other. Let's see if I have this here. This device is becoming my secretary, my entertainment. You know, I can watch television on this for free. And that's another thing, is that the new generation expects to get everything for free. And so do you. You have so many services, from MapQuest to buying your own airplane ticket. You expect it to be free and quick and at your fingertips. And now 3D television is coming. You know that, right? In high def. And so you'll be able to sit in the middle of the Berlin Philharmonic and watch the conductor up close. And you don't have to buy a ticket for $150 and to see a Broadway play. You'll be in the Broadway play with that wonderful, you know, technology that's separating us. Now, the Metropolitan Opera, you know, is broadcasting. And on one hand, and even Peter Gelb, the head of the Metropolitan Opera, is saying it cuts both ways. Because on one hand, they're taking the money. On the other hand, it's making it, again, completely okay that you don't go see a live performance. So is classical music still relevant? What is more relevant for this next generation? for a high school student who's going to Chula Vista, maybe learning how to play in a mariachi band is more relevant for them. And for some of them, it is. They do have mariachi ensembles. And that's right for them. Where's rock and roll and jazz and America's music in all of this? Or should classical music go the way of the dinosaur, or Renaissance music, or disco music? We've lost the context. I was telling you earlier, we've lost the context of what classical music meant to Mozart to entertain the aristocracy, for Verdi to write a powerful political opera to rally the masses. All of this has been lost. John Cage, someone mentioned John Cage, the experimental 60s and what music could or could not be. So I think the model is broken on not only in terms of what the public expects, but also what musicians and symphony boards and audiences expect. It's very difficult for orchestras to do something different these days. Believe me, as a conductor, you're between a rock and a hard place and a bunch of other things to completely lock you in. You've got a symphony board who remembers dearly what it was like to go to a concert with, you know, George Zell, Eugene Ormandy, Eric Leinsdorf, and they want that for themselves, and they've got the money, so they deserve to ask for that. I understand that. And you've got an audience that remembers that as well. And you've got orchestra musicians who were basically sold a bill of goods saying that if you practiced hard and you win a job, then you're set for life. It's like IBM in the 1950s, right? Being a company man. And now you're telling me I have to be interesting, and now I have to go out and meet the audience, and you got to go out to the schools? I didn't sign up for that. My teacher didn't tell me that. I think actually this is a great time. That's the positive message I'm trying to tell you, that in order for something to be born, it has to die and be reborn. And from this time of most difficulty, I think the companies that will survive and the orchestras that will survive will be stronger because of it. And it has to do with a dirty little word of the word non in nonprofit. Because we have been taught that the word deficit is a dirty word, or loss is a dirty word in the profit world. But in the nonprofit world, it's a badge of honor. We're not making any money. We're losing money. It's the way it should be. And that's business as usual. But what I would like to posit, what I'd like to put out there, is that if you look on the spectrum of the average American going to a public, going to a concert, or going to any kind of entertainment, they don't care that you're a nonprofit. Really, they don't. When you go to a movie house, how offended would you be if the movie manager came out and said, we're holding our annual fund right now, fundraising, and we'd like you to donate $100 and, you know, to keep this movie house going? It's like, I paid for this ticket. Or if you went to a restaurant and the chef said, you know, we'd like for you to donate to the restaurant. You know, and it seems absurd to you, but you have to understand the next generation does not have an understanding of philanthropy. They don't. And they don't even have a necessarily concept of subscribing to something. It, you know, you pay for it, pay as you go. But don't we all like convenience? We don't want to sign up for a year health spa. We like to go when we want to go. We don't want to feel guilty because of it. So what my whole perspective is now to place classical music out of the pantheon of the have and the haves versus the have-nots, and put it on the spectrum of, now, don't react, but of the word entertainment. Because that's how Mozart saw it. That's how Haydn saw it. Beethoven was a good entrepreneur. They were good business people. They were not priests. They were not martyrs. They wanted to make a living, and they understood how that fit into that. Handel, you know, just about every successful composer either knew how to work a patron or knew how to raise money directly from the public. And so somewhere along the way, institutions like orchestras saw themselves as public institutions. And while I'm a big supporter of NPR and the need for public support in universities, of course, I don't think orchestras should function that way, because they never had, or composers should function that way. Do you understand what I'm saying, historically?
Yeah.
Okay. So my journey, ladies and gentlemen, is to basically grow up. Because, again, when I took over the bankrupt symphony, if I didn't take a cold, hard look to find out what these very smart San Diegans didn't want in a symphony orchestra, I couldn't begin to do something different. I couldn't create something different. And we did a lot of innovative things, innovative programming, and brought in, you know, multimedia and created a new marketing image, et cetera, but the one thing I couldn't do was I couldn't, we were talking about lipstick and a wig before, I couldn't necessarily encourage the musicians to be happy. I could convince the public that I cared about them and that this music had something for them, but that connection, which I was talking about before, of when you see a musician on stage, do they care about me as a person sitting in the dark? So since then, I've also been music director of the New Haven Symphony and some other locations as well. I was music director at USC and San Francisco Conservatory. And I've been on this journey of finding out how to get musicians to play as if they're just completely on fire. They're just absolutely filled with the love of making music. Now, you've seen this before, but you've seen this with soloists. I know you can name me one or two soloists who play their brains out on stage. Go ahead.
Yo-Yo Ma.
Isaac Perlman.
Itzhak Perlman, who seems to enjoy himself with a great smile.
Yeah, Stern was like that, too.
Yeah, Stern was. But what of the new generation, who's as radical as Yo-Yo? There's a pianist that people are talking about.
Long-Long.
Absolutely. Who plays with great... And you can love him, or you can hate him. But he has touched a nerve that across the world that people are excited to see him. And you can... Nigel Kennedy from England, radical. He's like a kind of the first grunge violinist, if you will, you know, doing his own cadenzas for the Brahms Concerto and all this other stuff. And so, and you've seen perhaps some string quartets play like that. And so I used these youth orchestras and the World Youth Symphony Orchestra as my laboratory, but also I used to teach up at Idlewild School of Music and the Arts. And we would watch videotape of the Berlin Philharmonic and the Vienna Philharmonic, and we would see them playing with great energy and playing like soloists. And we'd say, why don't we see this in this country? And so we analyze them kind of like John Madden looking at a football game. All right, see this kid over here? You know, and notice how much bow he's using. Notice the eye contact. And I created this kind of Uber orchestra that would play as if everyone was a soloist. And now I can do it on a regular basis. I have this technique. The World Youth Symphony Orchestra, I just conducted the Texas Allstate, and you know the kids were playing as if they were rock and roll stars with great enthusiasm and passion. And now the second step was, can I bring this to a professional orchestra? Could I convince a group of seasoned, tough, union musicians to play like they were 17 years old again? The reason I can get young people to do it is because they still believe. You mean if I give my heart, it will make a difference? Sure. And they do it. And the electricity is palpable. I mean, just the sweat and the grins and okay, in order to do this, I'm going to have to put together my own special Mission Impossible orchestra, a group of musicians who believe the way that I do. And I need to start from scratch. But then San Diego Chamber Orchestra called me back and they said, you know, would you be interested in leading a concert? We're looking for a music director. And I said, well, no, you know, I love San Diego and my reputation there is wonderful. I hate to be the kind of person who has to come back to a party, you know, and just say I can't go. You know, I said, no, it's best if I, you know, just... They said, no, well, you know, we really want you to do this concert. And I did. And I came and I worked with this group of musicians who were just so enthusiastic and so... risk loving, and I said, okay, I'll take this on, but I really want to do something extraordinary. I want to create an orchestra of joy and of emotion, not of tuxedos. And I sat them in a big room just like this,
And I said, this is the deficit that this orchestra has, and this is the deficit that this orchestra has, and there needs to be a big change. And you know, just look at the concert halls, and we were talking about, look at the age of our audiences, and where's the next generation coming from? We need to do something drastic. So they didn't know what I was saying, because they'd never seen anything like that. But slowly over time, over the last 2 years we've been together, they have trusted me. And we do so many things that are different. We got out of the tuxedos and we wear these very cool, hip, interesting contemporary jackets. We completely did the update of the website, so it has much more of a graphic image. When you walk to the concert hall, the first thing you see is me and the musicians. How many orchestras do you know? Well, now some orchestras are copying us, but prior to that, no other orchestra, professional orchestra in the country, had their conductor and their musicians out in the lobby greeting people. But I didn't steal that. I mean, yes, I stole it from just good big. That's good business. That's not just good orchestra, but that's just good business. And so I was able to steal from you know, reading management books and the way Herb Keller ran Southwest Airlines or Ben and Jerry's ran their thing, or you know, and it came down to people and creating trust. So you walk into the concert hall and you sit down and you see this beautiful magazine that you're looking at right now. And I told my marketing manager, I said, don't create the same kind of tired program book that reads like a yellow pages. I want the stories to be interesting. I want the photographs to be gorgeous. I want it to look like a Martha Stewart meets Pottery Barn meets classical music. And you know, as you sit down and I don't take a separate entrance, the orchestra and I walk out together. Because sometimes it's like, you know, orchestra walks on, they sit down, conductor goes out, they smile, receive all the applause. You know, we're a family, and they feel that when rehearsal and the way I talk to them, they're colleagues. They're not less, they are, if anything, more than me. And the way that we bow together, the way that we greet our audiences after the concert together. So it's this orchestra has been kind of a dream for me, and now at the Cape Cod Symphony Orchestra, I've been trying to bring that same formula. So I'm just so excited about this, but I think really the bottom line is when you come see the orchestra, you see people having fun, energy, and the enthusiasm we have together. Again, we were talking about the word classical music. I don't want this to be a classical music experience, although I do like to program pieces you like. I like Mozart, and I like Beethoven and Mendelssohn this weekend as well. I will always program pieces that I think that you would like, and that's been my pleasure about being with the San Diego Chamber Orchestra over the past couple of years. So that's where we were, that's where I'm going, and God willing, I'll be able to go on for a couple more years in that regard. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.